Hi from Chicago, everybody. This is the Physics 142 lecture for September 18th, 2014. There is a sound file that is also posted on the class website, and the lecture you're listening to is accompanying the slides that are on the class website. If you have any questions, feel free to email me, and I'll try my best to answer them. Problem set 2 is due from you to me this week. Again, we will pick those up about, I guarantee you, not before 7 a.m. on Friday, but after that, could be any time. And solutions to problem set 1 are posted, and remember that I view it as part of your responsibility to come to closure on the solution sets and make sure you understand them and how they relate to your solution. Could be that what you find is that you've done things in different ways, but they arrive at the same place, and that's always a good thing to understand. Or you may find that you have something that you have not understood, or that there's a misprint or something in the solution set, and if so, you let me know. At any rate, if you refer to the slides that are posted on the web, let's go to slide 2. The slides are numbered in the upper right-hand corner with a light blue color. Okay, so last time we continued our discussion of Gauss's law, which you'll find to be very useful. And in the upper right-hand corner of this slide, I've written Gauss's law. The integral of E dot dA over a surface is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. This is true in general. It is not necessarily always useful. Sometimes it's useful very much conceptually, and you've seen some problems or have some problems in the problem set that where that is true. But it is also particularly useful under certain conditions of symmetry where the calculations on the left and right side are fairly easy to do, and by doing them you can get a determination of E at the surface, and sometimes that's very useful. So we've done an example or so of that so far. We'll do a couple of more. So last time I discussed curvilinear coordinates. In particular, in this class, we will mostly use spherical coordinates and cylindrical coordinates. And in these curvilinear coordinates, the little differential volumes you need to use when you do integrations over continuous charge distributions or whatever, it's complicated as compared to Cartesian coordinates. So there is such a thing as generalized coordinates. I'm not really going to do that, but we will talk about spherical and cylindrical. So I just want to remind you, I'm not going to go through it again, but on the right-hand side, I have pictures that describe, that define a coordinate system, the spherical coordinate system. So for a given point, which is, you can see what these figures show are as a Cartesian system, x, y, and z. And if I have a given point that has an x, y, z coordinate, you can also define that in terms of spherical coordinates by assigning it a radius, an angle phi, which is the angle down from the z-axis. I'm sorry, an angle theta, which is the angle down from the z-axis that goes from 0 to pi, and an angle phi, which is the angle from the positive x-axis in the xy plane, and that angle runs from 0 to 2 pi. And if you are in spherical coordinate systems and you choose a little three-dimensional cubish-like volume, such as that shown in the picture on the lower right, the volume element itself, in terms of these derivatives, in terms of these differentials in theta, phi, and r, is complicated. It's r squared sine theta, d phi, d r. I do think it's a good idea that you understand these. I think your understanding of it will be useful in this class, but it will be essential in the next classes that you do. We will take shortcuts so that most of what you can do with one-dimensional differentials and integrals in this class, but I think understanding where all this comes from, you may find very useful. So do look at what we discussed last time in class and understand where these scale factors, this r squared sine theta in the volume element, comes from. there is a nice discussion of this in David Griffith's book on electromagnetism, which I think you'd find on reserve in the library. So let's go on to slide 3. Slide 3, I show cylindrical coordinates, and in cylindrical coordinates you have the axis of symmetry, which in this case is the z-axis, and then you have cylindrical symmetry around that z-axis, or circular symmetry, if you will. And we define, you sort of think of the surface of a pipe as being the surface of the cylinder, and it has a radius r. So any given point in 3-space, you could define it as having a radius r from the origin, and then you can define the angle that the vector running from the origin out to the surface of the pipe happens to have in the xy plane as phi, which opens up from the positive x-axis. And in this case, again, we have a more complicated differential volume. It's equal to r d phi d z dr. And again, I talked about that on the in the September 16th lecture, so you do want to understand where that volume element comes from. It's also discussed in Griffith's. So just get on board with those, and I think you'll find it useful. All right, so let's go on to slide 4. You might ask, why does a differential volume, why is it that we have to integrate over anything? And the reason that we have to integrate over something is when the distribution that you're considering changes. So in the case of a charge distribution, for example, if I want to know what is the electric field of a charge distribution at some point P out away from it, if the charge distribution is changing within the distribution itself, I can't consider all that distribution really concentrated at a single point. If I want to know what the electric field is far away, I don't know how to even define that for a large diffuse charge distribution. The only way I know to do it is really I can define an electric field for a point charge. So if I have a charge, big Q, then if I'm some distance r away, I know that there's an electric field, which is the force per unit charge at that point, which would be K times Q over r squared. So that I know how to deal with. So the whole trick with doing integrals is you consider for a moment only a teeny tiny piece of that continuous charge distribution. And that we call a differential little piece. If I know just that piece, I can write an expression for the electric field at point P, a differential electric field from that differential little charge. Once I have that, then I sum up over all those differential little charges in that continuous charge distribution. And as I sum those up, of course, the distance and the direction may change, so it could in fact be complicated. But when I do that sum, which is an integral, you then get the electric field at the point. So that's just a reminder of why it is we're doing it the way we're doing it. So in order for this to work, you want to have this differential be so small in all dimensions that the charge distribution doesn't change over that little differential piece. You could have a very complicated changing charge distribution, but over that little tiny spot, the distance changes so little that the charge distribution you can consider constant. So that's what allows you to sort of think of this as a point charge when you try to write what its contribution is at point P, where you want the electric field or the force or whatever it is. So in that sense, typically when you want to do an integral in this way, you want to consider the differential to be differential in all of the dimensions. But the truth is, it only really needs to be small in the dimensions over which the distribution may be changing. So since I'm just a swell guy, I'm going to promise you that I will give you cylindrical and spherical charge distributions that have only a dependence on R. And so what that really means is I can imagine creating differentials which are only differential in the radial direction. So, for example, if I and what that means is that you can more or less for free write down the answer or integrate out, depending on how you want to say it, the angular pieces of this. So, for example, if you have something which has a spherical charge distribution or spherical geometry, say on the lower left, you can consider a spherical shell which has an area 4 pi r squared, and then allow it to basically push out a little differential dr. And if you consider that whole spherical shell element of thickness in r equal to dr, then the differential volume of that shell you can consider to be 4 pi r squared, which is the area of the shell, times that thickness dr. And you might say, well, the inner part of the shell and the outer part of the shell are different radii, therefore, how can I use just the 1 r squared in the angular piece, the 4 pi r squared? And the how and why of that is that they are only differentially different in R, which means it is a good approximation that they have the same radius. So in a spherical problem, you can use your differential 4 pi r squared dr. And if you go back to slide 2 and you look at a problem with spherical symmetry, if whatever it is you're looking at has no angular dependence, then the dv that you get, if you were to integrate over phi and theta in a problem that has no angular dependence, what you will find is that you'll get 4 pi r squared, which is the angular piece that we just assume for a problem which has the spherical symmetry. All right, so let's go back to slide 4. Similarly, if I have a cylindrical problem, then let's imagine I have a cylinder of length L and I want to integrate over that. Then if it has only radial symmetry, so that is radial being away from the symmetry axis, then I can consider a cylindrical shell, and that cylindrical shell will have an area which is 2 pi r times L. That would be the area of, say, the surface of a pipe, if you were to measure that, and then allow that to go out a differential dr. And so the differential volume, if you're doing cylindrical integration, is just 2 pi r L dr. So what this means is the minute I tell you that you don't have angular dependence in the charge distribution or whatever, for a spherical thing you can integrate over it, having the integral over the area, but only doing the r dependence in the integral, and your dv becomes 4 pi r squared dr, and for a cylinder it becomes 2 pi r L dr. So life is easy. Okay, so let's go on to slide 5. At the end of class last time, we did actually look at an example that's an important example. In fact, you'll find yourself just doing this calculation to remind yourself of what the field is outside of a line charge many times. But the example is, suppose we have an infinite straight line charge distribution. Let's assume that it's a positive charge that's positive charge distribution with a constant charge per unit length, lambda. So the problem is, what is the electric field everywhere? So to do this problem, let us imagine that we have a Gaussian surface, and we choose a Gaussian surface that has cylindrical symmetry, taking advantage of the symmetry of the problem, and we center the Gaussian on the axis of symmetry, which is the line charge. And then you might say, well, how long does the cylinder need to be? And you do have to worry about that, because when we use Gauss's law, we are integrating over a closed surface, which means you may be thinking pipe when you write this cylinder down, but it has end caps as well, so you do have to integrate over the full surface. Therefore, you really sort of have to think, okay, but this pipe has to have a certain length. And I haven't told you anything about the length, and in fact, it may seem strange to put something with an arbitrarily short length on a line that has an infinite length. So we just have to have it. I call it big L, and I just invoke it. I just put it there. And what will happen, as you'll find, is it'll come in both the left-hand side and the right-hand side of Gauss's law, and it will actually cancel out. So it doesn't really matter what it is. So we're just going to... But it is good to always put it in the problem, because it makes a good placeholder. I mean, you do need it in your calculations. And it's always good to put it in so you can keep things straight. So this Gaussian surface, where do you put this Gaussian surface? We have it... we mentioned why we have a certain length, and we talked about the symmetry, so we have to have cylindrical symmetry. At what radius do you do it? Well, in this problem, you just choose some radius. If I have other cylindrically symmetric regions of space in this problem, I would choose different Gaussian surfaces to basically look at what's happening in each of those regions. So we'll do examples like that, but that's not this. This one doesn't need that. This one has only one generic region of space, which is that region where R is not zero. So we choose a cylinder that has some arbitrary radius R, and now we use Gauss's law to evaluate E. Let's go on to slide 6. So if we go to slide 6, we want to look at Gauss's law. I have redrawn the figure with the Gaussian surface, but this time I have labeled it with a few things. So I have labeled the left-hand end cap, where the end of the cylinder is at right angles to the line charge. I've labeled that surface 1. The right-hand end cap, I've labeled surface 2, and so Roman numerals in green circles. And then the pipe, which the piece of the Gaussian surface which looks like a pipe, I've labeled region 3. So notice that in region 1, n-hat, or the vector dA, if you wish, n-hat being the unit vector perpendicular to that surface, is parallel to the line charge. If you look at region 3, for example, n-hat is always pointing outward radially. And if you look at region 2, n-hat is parallel to the line charge, but pointing away from you or to the right in this particular figure. So in this problem, and the reason we choose cylindrical symmetry, is if you look at it... there's nothing to give the electric field what I would call a left-right component, or a component that's parallel to the line charge. If I have a DQ way off to the right that would give me an electric field component going toward the left, I have, by symmetry, a piece over on the left that would be canceling that parallel component out, and the components that are radial would add. So the electric field by symmetry has to be radial here. So if we look at the left-hand side of Gauss's law, the integral over the full surface of E dot dA is really the sum of three different integrals. So the first piece is the integral over the left end cap, the second piece is the integral over the right end cap, and the third piece is the integral over around the pipe surface itself. So I've written in the middle of the page, in green, how E dot dA breaks into these three different integrals. The first term goes to zero because you're looking at the left-hand end cap, and you'll notice that the electric field points radially, and yet n-hat, or dA here, points parallel to the axis. Therefore, it is at right angles to the radial E, and so E dot n-hat is going to be zero. The second term is the right-hand end cap, and it is going to be zero for exactly the same reason. E and n hat are perpendicular to one another. The third term, that's not true because E is radial and n hat is radial, but because they're along the same direction, E dot n hat becomes the magnitude of E times 1 times dA. So you end up with just the integral over the circular pipe surface of E times dA. So another reason that we choose this particular Gaussian surface shape for this problem with cylindrical symmetry is that if all points of the pipe surface are at the same radius away from the line charge, again, there's nothing to break the symmetry. All of those points have to have the same electric field magnitude. So what that means is as I integrate E dot or EdA over that entire surface, E is constant at that particular radius. So E pulls out of the integral, and I'm left with the integral of just, I'm left with basically just the area of the surface of the pipe itself, which is 2 pi r times L. So the left-hand side of Gauss's law is 2 pi r times, is E times 2 pi r L. And of course, I'm doing this slowly. I actually do recommend that you, when you get used to this, you'll start just cranking these things out. I recommend you always take your time and go ahead and break the integral up into three components and just double check that, you know, the E dot dA you understand in each of those surfaces. It's sort of easy to somehow stumble and make a mistake. And in particular, that's true with cylindrical geometries, because what you'll find is that sometimes we use Gaussian surfaces that are cylindrical in actual problems of cylindrical symmetry, and as you will see, sometimes we use Gaussian surfaces that look cylindrical for simplicity, but we're actually using them in a Cartesian geometry. And in fact, you'll find that E dot dA in the way in which we usually use it for a Cartesian geometry or planar geometry things, E dot dA component is not zero. So you don't want to just get in the habit of seeing some pipe-shaped Gaussian surface and assuming that E dot dA is zero on the end caps. That's only true if you have something that's full radial symmetry in the problem. Anyway, back to this particular problem, infinite line charge. We've now evaluated the left-hand side of Gauss's law, which is just E 2 pi r L. And now what we want to do is evaluate the right-hand side of Gauss's law. The charge per unit length is constant here. It's lambda. And so I can evaluate the amount of charge that's inside the Gaussian surface by taking lambda and multiplying it by L itself. So the right-hand side becomes L times lambda divided by epsilon naught. So at the bottom, you can see what we get. If we assume a positive lambda, then the electric field will be radially outward. And if we solve for the magnitude of the electric field as a function of R, you find that it's lambda over 2 pi epsilon R. And just epsilon naught R, sorry. And just to remind you, the answer's wrong if you don't give me a direction, right? The electric field is a vector, so you have to tell me it's radial or preferably, you know, radially outward if I tell you the sign of the charge or something. So do remember that on exam problems or whatever. You will lose some points if you don't give me directions. But what we've now solved for with this simple Gauss's law is the magnitude of the electric field, and we know the direction from symmetry, as a function of radius from the line charge itself all the way out to infinity. So it's pretty cool. And you'll notice that this was really easier than, say, the you could imagine, since we calculated the electric field at some point z up from the midpoint in an earlier example, and you actually calculated the electric field directly at that point, not using Gauss's law, but using electric field integral. You might imagine being able to do the same thing here, but instead of integrating from minus L to L or 0 to L, you actually integrate from minus infinity to infinity. And yes, that should work. But I think this is easier. So that's the utility of Gauss's law in many instances. It's just ease of calculation. So let's go to slide 7. Let's do another example. This one also has cylindrical symmetry, but now it's a somewhat more complex problem. So let us imagine that we have an internal conductor which has cylindrical symmetry and a radius of big R sub A. And then we have a cylindrical shell with a finite thickness. That shell has an inner surface which is at radius R sub big R sub B, as shown in the second drawing down, and the outer surface of that shell has a big radius R sub C. We're going to say that the core, the piece which has a radius R sub A, is a non-conductor. Okay, so what that means is that the charge can be distributed throughout that conductor. And in fact, this time I tell you that it does have a constant charge per unit length, but that charge has a radial distribution, and that radial distribution is given by the function rho, which is the volume charge density. Rho as a function of R is equal to A times R. I guess I could have put lambda as a function of R because it's really sort of a linear charge per unit length, but it is now, well, no, let's see. It's a three-dimensional thing because you're now looking at how the charge is distributed in R. All right, so I think I've got it drawn right. So rho as a function of R, we're going to say, is equal to A times R. Now, this is a little a, and little a is just a constant. And it's a constant that has to have units. Since rho has to have units of coulombs per meter, to think about this a little bit, because rho is really, R is just a one-dimensional thing. Well, we'll see when we work it up. I think A here has to have units of it's either coulomb per meter cubed or coulomb per meter. Well, I'll have to hang on a minute. This is one of the things that makes this hard to do, because I can't just, I've got this thing recording, so it's hard to think on the fly. Just hang with me for a minute, and we'll worry about the units in a second. So rho of R is a function of R, and it's just equal to some constant, and we'll worry about the units on that in a minute, times R. So the problem is we want to find all E in all space. So this problem has different regions of space, okay? One is where little r, where the radius is less than big R sub A, so that would be inside the inner conductor. The other would be when you consider something where which has a radius between R sub B and R sub C, R sub A and R sub B, that is between the inner core and the inner layer of the outer sheath. And then there'll be a region between inside the sheath, so it would be have a radius between R sub B and R sub C, and then you'll have a region which is a radius larger than R sub C. So in this problem, the universe breaks into four different regions that you have to worry about. So to do the problem, you just basically consider Gaussian surfaces in each of these regions and try to calculate what's going on with E in each case. The problem has cylindrical symmetry, so you know that the electric field is pointing out radially, or in radially, depending on the charges, etc., but it's the electric field has radial dependence. So let us start with a little r less than big R sub A. So the Gaussian surface, if we look on the lower left of slide 7, you'll see the inner core drawn with its radius R sub A, and we consider a little Gaussian, a cylindrical Gaussian surface with its axis of symmetry exactly the same as the axis of symmetry of the core of the inner piece of this problem. And we imagine this Gaussian surface with R less than R sub A. And let's go to slide 8. If we go to slide 8, we know that E is radially outward, so if we consider this Gaussian surface, E dot dA on the end caps is 0, and we only really need to consider E dot dA on the pipe surface. So E is constant on that surface because you have radial symmetry in the problem. So we have the left-hand side of Gauss's law becomes the magnitude of E times the integral of dA, which on this pipe surface is 2 pi r times this length that we choose. We'll choose an arbitrary length, large L. So then the question is, what is Q enclosed? Q enclosed is the integral of rho dV. And I think here, we see that A has to have units of coulombs per meter cubed, because when you do this integral, it is a full three-dimensional integral. Even though we're thinking of it as a single-dimensional thing, we've already integrated out the angular piece, so that's 2 pi r. So I think the units of A will have to be coulombs per meter to the fourth, because the total units for rho has to be coulombs per meter cubed. At any rate, if we look at the right-hand side of A, the integral of rho dV becomes the integral from 0 out to little r. Little r, remember, is the radius of the Gaussian surface that we've chosen, and little r is smaller than the radius of that inner core, big R sub A. We don't integrate over the full inner core because we're considering a Gaussian surface which has a little r. So the integral becomes the integral from 0 to r of rho dV. Rho is a function of r, so we rewrite rho in terms of r, so it has this constant A times r as given in the problem in this region of space. And then we rewrite dV in terms of the r integral, which is 2 pi r l, 2 pi r l times dr. So that would be the volume element for the spherically, for the cylindrically symmetric problem with no angular dependence. The little a is a constant, and 2 pi l are constants. We pull those out, and it leaves us with r squared dr, and the integral of r squared dr between 1 to 0 and r is just r cubed over 3. So Q enclosed at the bottom right of slide 8 is a times 2 pi l times little r cubed over 3. So we can take the left and right-hand sides and equate them. So at the top of slide 9, we have the magnitude of E times 2 pi r l is equal to A 2 pi l r cubed over 3 epsilon naught is what we get with Gauss's law. And then we can solve for E. I go ahead and give it to you as a vector. I solve for E's magnitude using the equation at the top of 9, and then I use the fact that I know it's a radially outward to give you the direction and make it a vector. So we get that E is radially outward and has a magnitude of A times R squared over 3 epsilon naught. And note that if you look at the top of slide 9, the length of the cylinder in the Gaussian surface that we chose cancels out as promised. So don't let that stop you. And if you take out your little decoder rings of tricks and you program this one in, sometimes you shouldn't be bothered by things that you aren't given. Go ahead and assume what you need, put it in some sort of variable form, and then hope that it cancels out, and often life works out for you. Okay, so we have determined the electric field in the region where the radius is less than big R sub A. So the next thing to do is to consider the next region outward, which would be the region of space outside of that inner conductor, but inside of the inner surface of the outer shell. So this would be for big R sub A, which is less than little r, the radius we want to consider, which is less than big R sub B. And I have drawn in the middle of slide 9 a view along the symmetry axis of the Gaussian surface. So we choose a Gaussian surface in that region with little r between those two big R's. And again, we evaluate Gauss's law. Now, in this case, again, you have radial symmetry, so nothing changes the left-hand side. It's just the magnitude of E times 2 pi RL. And the right-hand side is different because now we evaluate the total charge enclosed inside that Gaussian surface. And we basically will have the same integral we had in the earlier region, except instead of integrating from 0 to little r, we only integrate from 0 to r sub a, because it's only out to r sub a do you have any charge. From r sub a out to little r, in this case, you have zero charge. So the right-hand side becomes the same as the right-hand side that we had for the first piece of the problem, except instead of little r cubed, we put the big r sub a cubed, because that's the upper limit to the integral. And you can then, at the top of slide 10, we evaluate the electric field, and it goes as A over 3 epsilon naught times big R sub A cubed over little r. And that is now the electric field in the region between the inner core and the inner part of the outer shell. Now notice that there is one point at which the solution for the inner core and the solution for this next region out have to be the same, and that's where r, little r, is equal to r sub a. So if we look at... Go to slide 10, yeah. If on slide 10 you look at the field which I have for the region between r sub a and r sub b, which I've written on the right beside the pink large A in a circle, and you compare that to the field for the inner core, which I've rewritten on the right at the top of slide 10, where it is beside the pink B in a circle. Those two fields, the solutions have to match when little r is equal to r sub a, that is the radius of that inner core. And in fact, you'll find that they do. If we let little r be equal to big R sub a, then the right-hand solution becomes a times big R sub a squared over 3 epsilon naught, and the left-hand solution becomes little a times big R sub a squared over 3 epsilon naught. So that's a check that you can do on how you're doing with this problem. You want to make sure that you match properly the boundaries. Okay, so we have now solved for the electric field in the inner region and the next region out. The next step is to solve for the electric field in the second region out. So that would be the region inside the conducting shell. Let me go back for a second at the start of the problem. I may not have said earlier, but on slide 7, if you look at the problem that I've set up, the region between R sub B and R sub C, that shell, that cylindrical shell, that's a conductor. Okay, that's part of the problem. So if we now return to slide 10, in the middle of slide 10, I now want to consider the region from R sub B, which is less than little r, which is less than big R sub C. And I, again, looking at it along the symmetry axis in the drawing, I choose a Gaussian surface that has little r between R sub B and R sub C. And I try to evaluate Gauss's law here. Well, remember that the electric field inside a conductor is zero. So the electric field there is zero. I don't have to do a calculation because it's inside a conductor. So that's the third region. And the fourth region is the region of space which has a radius larger than R sub C. So it is the region of space outside the outer conductor of that outer shell. So if we go to slide 11, you can see that from a view along the symmetry axis, I have drawn a Gaussian surface with little r where that Gaussian surface is now outside of big R sub C. Now if you look at this one, the conducting surface, in setting up the problem, the conducting surface I have not put any net charge on. So if we sum up the net charge inside this Gaussian surface, we should get exactly the same answer as we did when we did our second region. That is, if we allow the Gaussian surface to be just outside the inner core, because it's only the inner core where we have a net charge in this problem. And the left-hand side, because this is a Gaussian problem with radial symmetry, the left-hand side will be the same. So what that means is that the electric field radial dependence will be exactly the same for this outer piece as it is for the second region. So the solution for this outer region is written at the bottom of slide 11. And you want to go back and review how we got this for the second region to make sure you're happy with this. Okay, and that, again, it's radially outward. So that leads me to another question. Let's go to slide 12. What I've told you is that the conducting sheath, this conducting outer shell, has no net charge. And we know that the electric field inside the conductor is zero. But we know there's an electric field in the other regions inside, and we know there's an electric field outside. So what's going on here? The question I have for you is, is there a charge on the surface of the on the outer surface or the inner surface of this conducting sheath? I want you to stop the recording for a few minutes and think your way through this one. I would like you to tell me what you think the charge is that exists on the inner part of that outer sheath and the outer surface of that outer sheath. So I will not bother pausing. You can pause me electronically, but I will continue. So I'm going to let you ponder that one for a minute, and we'll come back to it at the end of lecture and discuss it. But let's now go to slide 13. So on slide 13, I'm going to actually start discussing energy considerations. And if you think back to mechanics, you may recall that pondering energy was very fruitful in mechanics. That looking at potential energies, potential differences in energy between as you stretch a spring or as you slide down a sliding board. There are many instances where energy was really great because the potential energy depended only on the position. For example, if somebody is sliding down a sliding board and if they're in a conservative system, so one where they're not losing energy to other things, you can basically use energy conservation, and the potential energy is given really only by the position of the person, and it doesn't really matter what they did in between. So in electricity, the world is very similar. I mean, you still have these energy concepts dealing with forces in electricity, just like you do in mechanics. And in fact, I would say it's even more of an integral part of electricity than we typically make it in mechanics. So on slide 13, we're going to start considering the electric field and energy. And generally, if you want to think about trying to consider energy in a system, what you really want to do is to think about work, and you want to think at first, you want to think about differences in energy, because that's a lot easier to ponder. I don't know what it means in a sense when I'm just beginning to look at a problem. What does it mean to have absolute energy? Where would I define the energy to be zero? I mean, you have to somehow think of the problem at hand if you're going to do that. But And it's also maybe open to definition. I mean, how do you define height? Well, height above sea level. You have to define the zero for that. So often that's the case for energy. So, but differences in height and differences in energy don't really depend on how you define your zeros. So let's just start out by thinking about the difference in energy in a simple electric system. So let us suppose, in the middle of slide 13, that I have the blue positive large Q, some charge. I'll just say it's a net, just a charge plus Q. And I have drawn red electric field lines coming out of that charge plus Q. So assume they have radial symmetry, even though they're not drawn beautifully, and et cetera. So we have a spherically symmetric problem. And now I have a little test charge, which I'll just call Q0, over to the right. And let's say that Q0 is at a position, which I show by big A, the green A. And what I'd like to do is to move little test charge Q0 in from A to point B. And for simplicity, we'll just say that we do this along a radial path. And because the electric field due to big Q is pointing outward radially, and because Q0 is a net positive test charge, I have to exert a force inward radially in order to move Q0 from A to B. And when I do that, I'll just say that I'm moving Q0 along a path where differential elements of the path I can call ds. And ds, if I've defined this path to be radial, then ds is basically pointing along dr except for its opposite, right? So ds is pointing towards q, not outward. So the question I want to ask is, given this situation, how much work is it that I do to move little q0 from A to B? So I can calculate the work. You can't forget this formula because it's always necessary. I can calculate the work as the integral of f dot ds from point A to point B that I do. And in this case, you'll note that I'm moving from A to B, and the force that I exert is also going from A to B. Since we say that we're moving along the radial direction, I know that F and ds will always be in the same direction. So F dot ds becomes F times ds. but I want to hold on a second because I'm making some changes in the slides, so just bear with me for a second. And then I'll say that again because it turns out what I've done on my slides currently is a little confusing. Okay, so let's do this again. I'm moving from A to B, and I'm moving along differential pieces ds. Okay, so I start out at the bottom of slide 13 with the integral work is equal to the integral from A to B of f dot ds. Now, ds has a direction which is inward. I can consider a little differential dr, which will be an integral differential r, which is pointing outward. So I want to be dealing in r instead of s right now. So what I'd like to do is go from the integral of a to b from f dot ds to dr instead. So if you go down on slide 13 from the original integral down one line, you see that that becomes the integral from a to b of the f dot minus dr, where the minus sign comes in because of the direction dr is different, is opposite that of ds. That then is equal to the integral from a to b of f times dr with the minus sign, but f and dr are parallel, so the dot product just becomes multiplication. And I can rewrite the force as q times e. So that's minus the integral from a to b of q0 times e times dr. And I'm going from, you know, a radius out where a is into where radius, where the radius where point b is. So that's the integral from r a to r b of q e dr. So I go to slide 14. I can pull the q out of the integral and rewrite what e is, which is kq over r squared for the charge big Q. And the k and the q pull out, and I do the integral of 1 over r squared, which is minus 1 over r, between the limits of big R A to big R B, and I get qk big Q times the difference, 1 over big RB minus 1 over big RA. I'm moving inward from A to B, which means RA is a bigger number, which means 1 over RA is a smaller number, which means this work that I've done is a net positive quantity. So that's a good check, because I know if I have a little test charge Q0 and I push it in towards the big charge Q, I have to do net work to make that charge move toward the other charge because they repel each other. So so that's good. So I've done work, and what we say in electricity is that the work that I, if I take that work and I divide it by the amount of charge that I do, so the work per unit charge that I do, we call that the potential difference between points A and B. So however much charge it is at point A that I then move to point B, the potential difference is the amount of work per unit charge that I do. So the potential difference is independent of how much charge I move over there, because it's work per unit charge. Now, you may remember that the work that I do also corresponds to the change in the potential energy of the system. When I have a big Q sitting out in space and I have a little Q0 sitting at point A, is there a potential energy in the system? And the answer is, you bet there is. How do you know there is? Well, if I let it go, those two charges are going to repel each other, and You know, you can think a big Q is going to repel little Q0, and little Q0 is going to start moving away. And so that means big Q is going to be doing work on little Q. So big Q, so the system has the energy. It has within it stored energy, because remember, energy is the ability to do work. And what is work? Work is moving something with a force through a distance. And so if I have these two charges in space and I let them go, then definitely the system is going to be moving things some distance with the force. So the system has within it a stored potential energy. And the work that I do to move, the work per unit charge that I do to move something from A to B is what I call the potential difference. The total work that I do, you can imagine what I've done is I've increased the potential energy of the system by the amount of work that I do when I shove the charge from A to B. When I tell you I've done a net positive work to the system, what it means is that it takes me effort to push the charge from B to A, because A is closer to big Q. I have also increased the potential energy of that system by exactly that amount of work. How do you know I've increased the potential energy of the system? Well, I know that I have, because now the charges are closer together. So if I were to let them go, they'll exert an even bigger force on each other and can exert more work on each other than they could have if they were further apart. So if we consider this potential difference, we can consider it as the change in the potential energy of the system per unit charge that I do. And we define, well, so there is this relationship between the potential and the potential energy in the system that you always want to keep in mind. We talk about this potential difference between point A and point B, and we often simplify that and just call it, you know, a delta V, where V represents the potential. So we might say it's delta V, or it is VB minus VA, or VAB, or whatever. And this potential difference has units. It's work per unit charge, so the units are in joules per coulomb. Okay, so I'm going to stop with the new material really for there. Let's go to slide 15 and come back to the problem that we were talking about earlier. Remember earlier we did this Gauss problem, and we had a charge distributed in the inner core, and this charge had a positive lambda, so there was a certain charge per unit length, and it was distributed as a function of radius out to R sub A with some simple function. And then between R sub A and R sub B, you have empty space, and we were able to calculate the electric field in both of those regions. And then we hit a conducting sheath that runs from, has an inner surface at R sub B and an outer surface at R sub C. And inside that conducting surface, the electric field is zero because it's a conductor. And then we calculate also the electric field in the fourth region, which is where the radius, where R is bigger than R sub C. And we found you have an electric field there. So how is it you cancel the electric field inside the conductor, and what does that mean for the distribution of charge along the surfaces? And the answer, it's really not bad. If I were to draw a Gaussian surface, cylindrical again like we did, between the inner surface and the outer surface of the sheath, so that would be R sub A is less than little r, which is less than R sub C, then we know that the electric field is zero. So what that means is inside that Gaussian surface, Q enclosed has to be zero. So the only way to have that happen is if, because we know that we have a plus lambda of charge per unit length on that inner core. And the only way I can have a Gaussian surface in the middle of the sheath where inside of it has no net charge is if the electric field inside the sheath induces, that is, it pulls enough charge in the conductor to its inner surface that it cancels out the charge inside of it. So I know that I have to have a minus lambda charge per unit length on the inner surface. Because if I have that, then when I sum up all of the charge inside that calcium surface, I know I get a Q enclosed of zero, and that allows me to have the electric field of zero in that region, which I know I have to have because I have a conductor. If I start out with the conductor having zero charge, net, and I have pulled a charge minus lambda on the surface, on the inner surface, I know that leaves an excess plus charge, plus lambda charge inside the conductor, and the only place for it to reside is on the outer surface. And so on the inner surface of the conductor, you'd have minus lambda. On the outer surface of the conductor, you'd have plus lambda. And I'm sure that's what you were all thinking, so congratulations. And I believe that is all for me today. I am going to go get dinner, and then probably will not put this on the web until tomorrow, which for me would be Thursday morning. So hopefully it will be up before you, if the network doesn't have any problems, it'll be up there before you go looking for it. At any rate, hope you guys are doing well, and have fun with the problem set, and have a great weekend. Bye.